you're involved now in a fundraising program. Can you give me an idea of what this is all about?
Okay. Well, as I saw this emerge here, I didn't pay a lot of attention to it early, and wasn't well enough informed to see the big picture of it. And then over time, I started hearing from people, I've got to learn more. And so I began to look at this from the big picture standpoint. And in the end, it comes down to whatever we want to say about the risk of over 2,000 pounds a square inch of CO2, which in concentration is a deadly gas. In low concentration, it's necessary for our plant growth, et cetera. But that is a danger. But the thing that concerns me the most, and has always been that, is that the principles by which our country was built on, and the constitutional foundation, and the property rights of the Fifth Amendment. And so as I looked at that, I thought, how are they going to sell the idea that they can get easements throughout 2,000 miles without somebody standing up and saying, I have a property right here, and you can't condemn my property for private use? And so as I looked at this big picture and sorted it out, talked to listen to people, it became clear that even though they said in the beginning, and I mean this is true as I understand from Summit and from Navigators, that we will not use eminent domain. We just want to build a pipeline and pay you for the easement. And I said, I can't believe that. Even then, a year ago, I couldn't believe that. It turns out not to be true because both of them have applied for eminent domain authority through the Iowa Utilities Board. And so that's the first thing, that maybe they changed their mind, maybe they weren't telling the truth. I'm not going to speculate on which that is, but I knew from the beginning they couldn't do this without eminent domain. And so here we are, eminent domain, 2,000 miles of pipeline, and people, it's the richest farmland in the world, being, I'll say, bulldozed through, excavated through, to lay a pipeline that sits there with the pressure that you'd have in the hydraulic hoses of the excavators that will dig the trench to put the pipeline in. And then people that have held this land in their families for 5 to 7 generations, this is something, property rights are sacrosanct in a free society going all the way back to 1689 when John Locke first wrote of life, liberty, and property. And those principles remain. They remain in the Fifth Amendment. They remain distinctly in the 14th Amendment. And they've been written throughout many of the state constitutions, life, liberty, and property, as that came before life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And in the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution reads, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Mm. Well, this in 2005, I'm on the Judiciary Committee in the United States House of Representatives, which I later became the chairman of the Constitution Subcommittee, and the Kelo decision came before the federal court. That Kelo decision was based upon Suzette Kelo, who had, I'll call it, a home alongside a bay in New London, Connecticut. New London, Connecticut decided, they actually cut a deal with a developer who had a deal with Pfizer. If they'd go in and condemn the residential property along this shoreline that Suzette Kelo held her dream home in, then Pfizer would build, they would pay the developer, Pfizer would build the plant. So the city of New London stepped in and condemned all of that property and handed it over to the developer. Well, Suzette Kelo said, I have property rights, I'm going to defend it. She didn't have money. She had a home that she barely scraped together and worked really hard to put together, but she found an attorney that would take it on and found a way to get this done and got it funded. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the very liberal Supreme Court in 2005 ruled that as long as it was for a public, not for public use, but for a public interest or a public purpose, which was to get a higher tax value out of the land. Now, when you step into that, when you go outside of property rights for higher tax value, then that means there's no private property in the country that's protected by the property rights that are in the Fifth Amendment, because you can always define it as, well, for the public good or the public benefit. In any case, the 5-4 decision of the Supreme Court came down on Kelo, and I had Justice Scalia as a guest speaker in a breakfast that I've long hosted in Washington, and we looked eye to eye across that table, and he said, this decision is incorrectly founded, and it will be reversed one day. And yet, the Kelo decision doesn't actually even apply to what they're trying to do here, because the Kelo decision had a government entity as an intermediary. But we have the pipeline companies that are applying to the Iowa Utilities Board. It's only a 3-person board two of them as a majority who could vote to grant eminent domain authority to Summit or to Navigators or to the Wolf operation. Now, when you think of that, this Kelo doesn't give them any path or any right to condemn property from private to private. No private entity should be able to go in and condemn private property for their own private interests. If that can happen, then the people with the money and the people with the influence can run roughshod over all of those that hold their property and believed, as I grew up believing, if you buy your property, pay your mortgage, pay your taxes, nobody can take that from you. So this is an essential principle here. And I believe that if the legislature doesn't stop this, then that isn't going to end there. I cannot imagine them building 2,000 miles of pipeline without litigation. And neither can I imagine that litigation just essentially collapsing in the early stages of it. And I would tell people that when you get into federal court and you have a precedent like the Kelo decision, Supreme Court precedent, you're never going to win at the district court level or the circuit court level because they're going to have to refer to the Supreme Court. So if this enters into federal litigation, it will either be killed early and people will give up, or once it's entered into, there has to be with the determination to go all the way to the Supreme Court. Now, I hope that that doesn't come to that, although there's a part in my heart that would like to reverse Kelo and go to Justice Scalia's grave and say a prayer of thank you for the inspiration that he's given me personally. But the cheapest way to kill this, and it should be killed unless they can build this thing with the full consent of the people that own the property, but the cheapest way to do it is in the legislature. But the legislature, I'm going to be cautious how I say this, because many of these people I know, like, and respect, and they're trying to do their due diligence. But sometimes you get caught up in something and it's hard to see the principle that's being trampled by all of the influence of the high-powered people in the state, the money that's involved in this. Bruce Rastetter would be, what, the top mogul in this kind of thing in the state of Iowa. And I just looked back through some records. He's put about at least $1.7 million into state house races and statewide local Iowa races. And that's over a period of time. I'm convinced it's substantially more than that. But when you look at the people that are for this, it looks like, well, it must be a good idea because the highest powered people in Iowa politics are involved in it. That's not a way to be rational. I can tell you that with personal experience. But there are four living governors in the state of Iowa, and each one of them has played a role in this. They're all in one way or another. Chet Colbert signed the first document in 2007 that opened this up and set the stage for CO2 pipelines. That was before any of the rest of us ever heard or thought of anything about it. And then, of course, we know Governor Branstad is in this with both feet. And so far, that there have been a number of reports that he's just lost his temper with people that disagreed with him. And that tells you that he's not as confident as he was when he started in on this. That's my sense of it. Governor Vilsack, as the attorney, as the Secretary of Agriculture, he sits there with a finger on the power levels in Washington, D.C. and the Biden administration and what was coming out of the House of Representatives and out of the Senate. And I said earlier that this is the Green New Deal. It's AOC's Green New Deal as processed by Pelosi and Schumer and AOC. And I just think it's a cross-wired spark that emerged from her head that somehow got legs, and I think Schumer was afraid she'd run against him as in the Senate, so he pushed it through the Senate. Now we have this. Nobody voted for this knowingly, at least. So we've got a Green New Deal that comes at us, and now it's being pushed by some of the people that opposed, that said that global warming was a hoax. And I'll tell you that I know that Bruce Rastetter and his team ridiculed the people that were promoting the global warming idea as recently as 10 to 12 years ago. But now they see the profit opportunity to scoop up tax dollars. There's not a dollar in this that's incentivized by private sector. This is all our tax dollars pumped into this. And what they said from the beginning is, well, we're going to invest $4.5 billion in the construction of 2,000 miles of CO2 pipeline of various diameters, and that whole network is going to go up to North Dakota. And in that $4.5 billion will draw down $12.5 billion in revenue. That's $12.5 billion of our tax dollars. And so the return on investment there is a 3-to-1. There was a bill that almost got passed, I'll say, that would raise that $50 a metric ton of CO2 to up to $85. If that happens, that would be over $20 billion they're looking at. So you can see why they're so intense. And then with Summit, he's far and away, Rastetter, Branstad, far and away the most wired in politically. I know that there was at least one state house race where there was a primary candidate that was against the pipeline, and amazingly, $11,000 was dropped into his opponent's campaign to buy the ads that beat the conservative candidate who was opposed to the pipeline. That's only one thing I know of from the discussions that I've had, but that had to have happened multiple times around the state. So I'm going to say that the politics of this have been wired in, and the people at the highest level in the state government are involved in this. In Governor Reynolds last year seemed to be clear that she was opposed to the pipeline. This year, she seems to be straddling this a little bit. And I think what has happened is this, that they have decided at the hierarchical level of the Republican and perhaps the Democrat Party in Iowa, too, that they are going to slow walk any legislation that would slow down, regulate, or kill this pipeline in the General Assembly this year. And slow walk is a legislative expression for, if we just drag our feet and go slowly, we'll get to gaveling out, sine die is what we call it, at the end of the General Assembly session. We'll get there without even having to vote on anything that has to do with this pipeline, because we have people that don't want to take a vote on this. Now, they also have a rule which we call the Hastert rule in Congress, in the House, but it's a policy and a practice, not really a rule, that says we'll not bring a bill through committee or to the floor that doesn't have the majority support of the Republicans who are in the majority. And so that's the one that says if many of the Democrats are opposed to this pipeline, it seems to me that the rank and file ones are. And if you put this on the floor and said you're not going to condemn property for a pipeline with a bill that did that, or even require the legislature to put up an affirmative vote to go on record saying I'm for condemning your property to build this private sector pipeline that will only benefit the investors in it, if you put that on the floor, you would find out where they stand. But meanwhile, they just say, no, we don't have the votes, so we're not going to move it. I say they have the votes, and they don't want to move it because the leverage at the top of this thing has been so strong and so powerful that they want to slow walk this thing and put it behind them and then say, well, we did what we could do, but we didn't have the votes. That's what they said last year. That's what's being prepared to tell us this year, AJ.
And as a result, the people who are suffering the most are running into a situation now where they're running out of options. Because of that, I mean, if you don't have your legislature behind you helping you trying to solve this problem, does it stand to reason that they're not possibly representing the people per se, as they're supposed to do, as it's called for in the Iowa Constitution, the United States Constitution, and everything else?
Well, I think that's true. And, you know, there's something about being in the legislature. Many of them just want to stay out and stay away from the heat. And when you position yourself like that, it's how do I avoid catching criticism from either side? And so they get to the middle of the pack and huddle in the middle of the pack, and the wolves are on the outside, and they're picking off those that stray away from the pack. That's kind of the way they think about that. Mine has always been, I gave an oath to the Constitution, and I'm obligated to defend that Constitution, even though the U.S. Supreme Court made an erroneous decision on property rights. I'm obligated to defend those property rights regardless. And what they did with the Kelo decision, by the way, is they struck three words. They effectively struck three words from the Fifth Amendment that says, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. When I went to the floor to argue against this decision in 2005, I made that argument that they had struck three words for public use out of it. So now it just reads effectively, nor shall private property be taken without just compensation. In other words, they can't steal your property. That would be all the Fifth Amendment actually means as far as property rights are concerned. I didn't know at the time that I formulated that argument that Justice Sandra Day O'Connor had written the same thing in her dissent. I hadn't read the dissent. I just had my own. And by the way, Barney Frank, a lot of your listeners will still remember, one of the more liberal members of Congress from Massachusetts, he and I agreed on this almost exactly and we went back to back on the floor. I thought I would be rebutting him. Instead, I was agreeing with Barney Frank. This goes across the political spectrum. The property rights go across the political spectrum. But we need legislators that are strong enough, have enough character, and believe in their oath to stand up and say, all right, leadership, I know you've got some kind of a implicit agreement with Bruce Rastedt or Terry Branstad, perhaps the governor and others. But at this point, I can't, in a good conscience, trample over the property rights of the people in this state in order to enrich some people that are already rich, and the rest of us have no shot at that. I'll add another thing to this, AJ, and this will maybe be a little stunning to your listeners, but if this was something that needed to happen, there's no possible way to measure any return on investment here, no possible way to measure by looking at the thermometer for 100 years if we make any difference in the Earth's temperature, which, by the way, I got to a little place warmer as I'm speaking right now. It's okay with me to be a little warmer. but nonetheless, there's no possible way to measure the results of this investment, that if you say, of our tax dollars. On top of that, this is borrowed money. We're running in deficit spending that is beyond our ability to even comprehend the great national debt we have. Well, we're, what, $31 trillion and counting and projected to continue to go up. So how do we deal with that deficit spending? We borrow. And where do we borrow money from? China. And China's pumping CO2 into the atmosphere faster than we could take it out, by far. So is India, by the way. So we go to China and borrow money, and they're making money off the interest, at least, if they're not invested in this. And we don't have a way of knowing if they are or aren't. So it's possible that the Chinese are invested in this, and we're loaning them, or they're borrowing money from them. They're loaning it to us. We're paying them interest. They might have a twofer on this. A payload both ways, I might say, in the trucking business. I don't know that, but Saudi Arabia is surely invested in this. That's another place we borrow money from. So they have a double going on this, too. I can't find a way that this makes sense. If you wanted to do something about reducing CO2 into the atmosphere, then you should bring your leverage against China and India. And by the way, our ethanol plants are carbon neutral. You take a bushel of corn, it's roughly a third protein, a third starch, and a third CO2. And you take that bushel of corn and you take the starch, turn it into ethanol, take protein, turn it into a number of products, but primarily dried distiller's grain, which is it's a high quality feed additive. And that goes out at a premium over the price of corn. And then the CO2 is let back into the atmosphere. But if you feed that corn to a steer or a hog, it goes back into the atmosphere out of the back end of the steer or the hog, and it's net neutral on CO2. Every time I turn this Rubik's Cube around and look at it, it looks worse and worse. And I'll say it starts to me thinking about the boondoggle that it is. This is the biggest boondoggle I have ever seen in the state of Iowa. And at the national level, I have to pause when I don't know if I can apply that for sure, because there have been some big ones, but this one competes in my memory of one of the biggest boondoggles, and it's a scam on the taxpayers. I don't want my tax dollars spent to enrich some people to pump CO2 through 2,000 miles of pipeline up to the oil fields in North Dakota and then pump them down into the ground where they say, well, we wouldn't use it for fracking. Oh, really? Well, you use it for fracking every place else that you can get your hands on CO2, and it works really great. And speaking of fracking, Harold Hamm, the father of fracking, Continental Resources is a company that he is the CEO of, and he's a multi-billionaire, is invested in this. And he and Bruce Rastetter teamed up several years ago to put this plan together. And so it is the father of fracking and one of the early ethanol moguls we had in the state of Iowa, Bruce Rastetter. As far as I can determine, he doesn't have a dollar invested in any Iowa ethanol. But when I go to look this up, and I came across it by happenstance several years ago, not that many, he started building an ethanol plant in Brazil. And so I looked that up just the last few days, and the plan was to build, and remains, to build 6 ethanol plants in Brazil. There are 2 of them. One's completed. Another one's ready to go online, real close to ready to go online anyway. And another one's being started. He's almost halfway there on the 6 ethanol plants in Brazil. And his operation, Summit, is telling us, we have to have this pipeline to save the ethanol plants in Iowa. Well, what's the biggest competition we might have to the ethanol markets? Well, it'd be the Brazilian ethanol producers, of which he is the mogul down there. And so if you dump 1 billion gallons of ethanol into the marketplace out of Brazil, and I'm picking that number out of the air, really, but it's actually fairly close. If you dump 1 billion gallons in, what's that do to the markets of ethanol here in the United States and in Iowa? Furthermore, they're saying that this opens up the ethanol markets in California for Iowa ethanol, which can't sell to California because they have, I think we've talked about this in the past, set up a board called California CARB. They did that maybe 15 years ago. California CARB was formed in order to write regulations that would lock corn ethanol out of California in preference to sugarcane ethanol, primarily out of Brazil. And so that idea was they wrote the regulations rather than just say, we're going to give preference to sugarcane ethanol. It was about the CO2 emissions and the energy uses that they've been producing the ethanol. And so as it turned out, and I'm going from memory here, we have one ethanol plant in the state of Iowa, Sioux County, that is a wet plant, and they do qualify to export, or I'll say to ship, ethanol to California. And there's a premium on that. That premium, I'm going from memory here, is something like a 7% premium. You might say between 20 and 40 cents a gallon premium for the ethanol going into California because their prices are higher because they wrote the regulations to lock our corn ethanol out. Well, if these plants have CO2 pumped out of them, or if Iowa's plants, if they connect to a CO2 pipeline and they send that CO2 up to North Dakota, pump it a mile down into the ground, those plants will automatically qualify to sell ethanol into California, unless they change their regulations, by the way. But regardless of whether they do that or not, and you can about expect California to do that because their intent was to lock our corn ethanol out of their state. If their intent hasn't changed, they'll change their regulations. But even if they don't, you put 22 ethanol plants in Iowa and the rest of them that are part of all this, and they all can send their ethanol into California, there's no premium anymore. It's gone. And so what is left when Terry Branstad says we must pass this and we must get this bill to save ethanol in the state of Iowa? What's he talking about? They haven't told you anything logical that can't have all kinds of holes poked in or the fabric of it ripped to shreds just by the facts. But here is what they're talking about. That is the $12.5 billion, more likely $20-plus billion, in the long-term return on an investment, every dime of it tax dollars for this sequestration of CO2 or perhaps utilization for fracking. And that is, I talked to an ethanol plant board member whom I trust and will remain anonymous, who told me that Bruce Rassetter had come to them perhaps a year or two ago and said, Summit will take the CO2 off of your hands. We'll run a pipeline down here. We'll set the compressor system up. We'll press it up to 2,100 pounds or whatever and pump it out of here, and it won't cost you a dime. And now you'll be able to access California markets. Well, these guys on this board aren't dummies. And so they said, let's think about that a while. They thought about it a while. They got educated a while, and they ended up with an agreement that they would be paid, get this, $400 million for their ethanol coming out of their plant. Now, I don't know how long that is, whether it's a 10-year contract or what it is, but he said to me, we'll make more money off of selling CO2 to Summit than we will off the ethanol itself. So, but that's all tax dollars. That's all borrowed money. So what kind of a deal is this? I would take it around to this. The property rights that are, I'll say, sacrosanct within our Constitution, those property rights we need to protect. And if we're going to be consistent with the Constitution, then we should be consistent with one of Terry Branstad's previous endeavors. And that is this. If you're going to condemn private property, you have to be a government entity. And they have no government entity except the supposed permission of the Iowa Utilities Board. So if he were serious and consistent, he would say, you know, this is so important. It's so important to ethanol. If we're going to save the ethanol industry in Iowa, which, by the way, is posting record profits, if we're going to save them, do this. Set this whole operation up as a public utility, a public company, and let the taxpayers be the beneficiaries of this. If it's that important, if $12.5 billion are going to come in, maybe $20 billion are going to come in, why not use that to buy down the taxes of Iowans instead of enrich these people that are that are at the top of this thing that are trampling on our property rights. Then they could stay consistent with the Constitution itself. And so, that seems like a great big wild idea. But you know what? Terry Branstad pulled that off back when they built the ICN, the Iowa Communications Network. And that ran cable all over the state into public buildings in every single county and many of the other cities that were there. And I actually had the job of managing that when I was in the state Senate, oversight, I should say. So he's been there once before. If he's really serious, come back around here, Governor Branstad, and say, you know what? We can't really trample on all those property rights. The Constitution won't let us do that. It won't let us transfer private property to a private company without a government entity in the middle. But we can declare this to be a public interest because we can draw down these federal tax dollars and buy down state taxes with that. I don't think he's going for that. And I don't think he's going for that because they are invested out of that thing that our founding fathers, a motivation they describe as avarice, AJ.
Just as a side note, just as a side thought, you brought up this idea about Brazilian ethanol going on right now. And of course, Brazil is a big corn market. They export all over the country, all over the world, even to China, et cetera, et cetera. Is there a possible concern that we may start to draw down from our own reserves by or not process as much corn as, say, maybe Brazil now getting into the corn market and utilizing that along with the sugar cane ethanol as well, too? Is that a possibility that the corn farmers here in Iowa could actually be at a detriment because Brazil is taking over the market?
Well, I saw some of those numbers that are actually projected by Bruce Rastetter and Summit. And I don't know if I know exactly what the corn production is in Brazil today, but the predictions were that they'd already increased their corn production something like a factor of four times. And it was on its way to 4 billion bushel a year coming out of Brazil. That's a lot of corn.
It is.
That's just plain straight up competition. One country to the rest of the countries in the world, that'll change the markets. I'm convinced of that. And the ethanol is important. There's no question about that. It's going to have to compete within a marketplace. And to think that we would subsidize ethanol by paying to pump CO2 into the ground in an oil field after 2,000 miles of travel through a pipeline, that to me is a bizarre proposal. And we have people out here that are, I think they're sound scientifically, although I haven't examined the science myself yet. And that we have places and formations in Iowa where we can pump this down and secure it. That hasn't really been explored enough, but the Iowa geologist does make that assertion multiple times with state legislators. There's a lot cheaper way to get rid of this CO2 than do this complex pipeline business. And then there's also methodologies to convert CO2 into gases that can be used. And there's a couple of different options there that I can see. Senator Dennis Guth has brought some of that forward, and I think he's on solid ground, and he's in your neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So I want to put a shout-out for Dennis Guth. He understands this from a property rights standpoint. I believe he's a shareholder in an ethanol plant up there, and still it comes down on the side of property rights. That's a principled and noble man that will do that, and we ought to listen to him about the options that we have, AJ.
So where do you go from here now, Steve? I mean, you've got this program going forward now, and are there ways that people can get involved in this? What can they do? How can they get involved?
Well, we are raising money, and we definitely need to do that. It's we're up against a multi-billion-dollar behemoth here, and the little checkbooks of the regular people here just aren't enough. We've set up a website. I didn't write that down in front of me. What's going to happen is this Zoom is going to cancel us out in about 3 minutes.
Sure.
And then I'll send you another link.
Okay.
And by that, when I do that, I'm going to have the link for the website. We've raised a little money. We put together some radio commercials. We put some other strategy together here. I'm writing many of the legislators myself. We have others that are doing the same thing. We have people that have come down to the Capitol building 21st of February. Several hundred showed up down there. To protest the defense of their property rights. I can tell you that people are irate about this. And I've asked them to go watch the video, Little Red House, It's just a little red house. It's free on Amazon Prime, if you happen to have that. And I knew all about that case. I'd argued about it. I read up on it. The Congressional Record's got a lot of my remarks on it in there. But I didn't watch the movie until maybe 3-4 months ago. And once you see what happened to to Suzette Kelo and their neighbors, their life's dream taken away. To no purpose, by the way, because they never got all that built. They confiscated the property, however. Then you understand that a lady that bought a house just a few years earlier and developed it out had that kind of passion for her little red house. But what about these farms out here, these farms that have, when you grow up on a family farm and you end up with the successor to farm that land, you inherit the legacy of everyone that's gone before you. And whether it's one generation or five or seven, you inherit that legacy. That land means something to you. And when I've watched this during the 80s, when we had people, I go to these farm sales that were every week, there were multiple farm sales in the neighborhood. The bulletin board in the bank had them. You go to the convenience store, the flyers were there. And I go to those sales, and I'd see a mom standing there with maybe as many as five kids around her holding their hands, and they're crying, watching the last stuff sell on the hay rack, and dad's up there on the hay rack adding a hammer to the 5-gallon bucket with the junk in it, trying to get another dollar out of it. And what they've lost is not only their life's ambition, their life's dreams, but they've lost the legacy that was passed on to them by their previous generations. That rips your heart out when you see that. This is happening all across this state and the four and five other states that are involved. We've got to respect. They have a constitutional protection, and they have a deep legacy and a passion for this land. And I cannot imagine that they can condemn property over all of this land and not end up with litigation unless the legislature steps in and protects the property rights, which they have an obligation to do. And there's another point that I'd forgotten, and that is, if you go and look at the Republican Party platform, which we have Republican majorities, House and Senate, Republican governor, presumably they endorse the platform. The platform surely endorses them. And I've always made a career out of attempting to pass those planks in the Republican platform. There is a plank in that platform that says private property shall not be confiscated or condemned or used eminent domain, whatever the exact language is, for private use. We oppose that as a party. So we have legislators that are actively opposing an important plank in the platform. And I would want to remind those legislators that are doing that a congressman in Texas, Tony Gonzalez, a Republican congressman, was just a couple of days ago censured by the Republican Party in Texas for failing to support the platform. He'd gone against principled tenets within the Republican platform, and they censured him by a vote of something like 54-5. Nobody wasn't really much holding back on that. So we've seen that censure happen with Joni Ernst's vote on the same-sex marriage issue, which went directly against the platform. There were others that muzzled themselves because they didn't want to cause this kind of a problem. But I would just I am certain that if they slow walk this legislation through, gavel out, signy die, and the utilities board then goes, well, I guess we waited an adequate amount of time, we're going to go ahead and grant the eminent domain to the companies. If they do that, there will even perhaps before they do that, you will have parties, you'll have county Republican organizations that will bring motions to censure legislators who did not step up to defend the Constitution and do their jobs.
Tremendous situation. Steve, thanks very much.